Intel journalist. My name's Michael O'Connell. I'm here today with the entire political team for the Digital First Media.
All both of you.
Ryan Teague Beckwith and Amber Phillips are here today. I'm going to try something a little different. Why don't you introduce yourselves? Tell me a little bit about each of yourselves.
Sure. My name is Ryan Teague Beckwith. I am the politics channel manager of we call it Thunderdome. That's sort of an informal name, but the Digital First Media project to provide national news to our local newspapers. So, for lack of a better term, I also teach journalism at Georgetown School of Continuing Studies. And I run a local blog called the Hyattsville Wire.
Cool. And Amber?
Yeah, I'm Amber Phillips. I work with Ryan here in D.C. as kind of Thunderdome's D.C. political reporter and producer. And before that, I was at a local newspaper in Boston. And before that, living in Taiwan doing journalism.
And you just started there in August?
Yeah, about in August.
And you've been at the Thunderdome for how long?
Since the August prior to that. And before that, I worked at CQ Roll Call and the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina, and various other places.
Okay, cool. So what do you guys do differently as far as your political coverage compared to other news outlets?
Yeah, so a couple of things. Like we lean more on aggregation than I think a lot of other D.C. bureaus. And partly that's a business reason and partly that's an editorial reason. The first thing I say is that like our audience doesn't come to our websites for politics. People aren't going to the smaller papers in our chain and saying, gosh, I wonder what Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said today. I think probably a fair percentage of people reading our stories probably don't know what Harry Reid's title is, or if I said who's the Senate Majority Leader wouldn't know it. So we're not looking at that Politico audience that is really there for the latest, you know, who called who what in the cloakroom kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So what we spend a lot of time doing is saying, all right, what's going on in D.C.? We pay really close attention to what's going on in D.C. We read all of that kind of coverage. And then we say, what does that mean for you? How do I get you interested in a story that I think is important? Or how do I let you know something that's going to affect you, like unemployment benefits are ending? And that could affect you greatly. And here's why it's happening. And here's what may happen next. And here's what you need to know. So and then we also look at things from the perspective of what might get someone to click on this, you know, who wasn't necessarily looking for a politics story. So we try to come up with sort of catchy, fun ways to ease into it. And that means it's sometimes more fluffy things. Like the other day, it was, you know, which former reality TV star is thinking of running for Congress, and, you know, click here to find out. It was Clay Aiken.
Okay.
But then he decided by the end of the day, he decided he didn't want to run after all.
So. Oh. Well, thank you for wasting our time, Mr.
I know.
Aiken.
Yeah, really. I mean,
it's before he wrote it.
I used to live in Raleigh, so, you know, I'm quite familiar with the ups and downs of the Clay Aiken story.
Oh, okay. Well, cool. So who do you see as your audience then? I know that – well, let's back up a second. Digital First Media, for lack of a better defining aspect of it, is it's really kind of a conglomeration of lots of different –
we're a chain
outlets.
Of newspapers. Yeah. I mean, I think Digital First Media is like – the one unfortunate thing about it is that's a relatively new name because we used to be two chains that people were more familiar
right.
with, the Journal Register. And the – so a lot of times when I'm in D.C. and I call someone, I just say, hi, this is Ryan from the Denver Post.
Yeah.
People have heard of the Denver Post. They've heard of the San Jose Mercury News. And depending on what part of the country they're from, they might have heard of the York Daily Record or one of our other smaller
sure.
papers. So we're just a chain of newspapers, just like Gannett or something else. And we're actually one of the larger chains. But we rebranded the name as part of an effort by our publisher to look at, like, where is news going next? And really, you know, our mission is to transition from being a chain of newspapers to a chain of news sites.
Mm-hmm.
And more broadly, too, to keep our eyes open for other opportunities. And you know, we regularly get emails, sort of all company emails about, oh, we're investing in some new ad, you know, taxi product that will help advertisers. And some of the – I'm not the best person to ask how those all work. But – you know, we're regularly investing in different things. We have a partnership with Tout, which does longer form videos, sort of a long form Vine.
Mm-hmm.
30 seconds is long form on the internet. But so we, you know, we're kind of searching for how to take news into the next century.
Mm-hmm.
And So that can be a little confusing because we're not there yet and no one's there yet.
Right.
But you know, essentially we're a chain of newspapers.
Okay. Well, then back to that question, who is your audience? Who do you – when you interview people, when you write the stories that you're doing, who are the people?
I think Amber can talk to that.
Yeah. Well, I would argue, you know, our audience is absolutely people outside D.C., outside the Beltway, who don't read Politico's playbook every morning, probably have never heard of it.
Although you guys read that.
Yeah, we read it all the time.
There's so much to read. It's exhausting, really, to be a D.C. reporter.
We spend a lot of our days reading and then writing it for the average person. When Ryan was hiring me, he said, you know, my goal is to get someone to read a politics story and doesn't realize they're necessarily reading a politics story. Mm-hmm. One example of that is when unemployment benefits were expiring at the end of this year. We looked at other news events that might be tough on working class families, like the sequester is going to continue and cut into Head Start. Food stamps are going to be cut. And we wrote a story like, you know, why it could be a tough Christmas for working class families. And I think that lends itself more to the average reader than someone inside the Beltway.
Yeah, I mean, if the headline says, like, why this is going to be a tough Christmas for the working class, like, mm-hmm. then you're going to read that. You're not thinking, oh, this is a politics story. Like, nothing really turns people off, like, terms from politics. So we were just talking about, oh, we need to write about the farm bill. Can we do it in a way that we don't use the words farm bill anywhere near the headline or the lead? Like, can we bring this up as a topic without telling you, like, let's discuss the House majorities. You know, I mean, just people don't care about that stuff.
Yeah. It's too easy in writing this stuff to sort of fall into the pattern of tech speak and wonk speak of, you know, what wonk speak in and of itself is an example of itself. Yeah.
Another challenge that we have to think about with our readers is we own papers all over the nation. I mean, Jim Brady has said on this podcast, we have them concentrated in the Bay Area, in California, all over the East, in Colorado, everywhere. So, you know, when I talk to congressmen and try to explain who we are and why they should talk to me, you know, we have to get over the idea that it's regional, that even though we're writing for these local sites, we're not necessarily writing about regional issues. We really have to keep it very national.
Do you feel then that you're sort of writing, you're sort of a generalist in a way, in sort of your approach? Even that's not saying that there's not content. Of some depth.
Well, I think you have to look at it. I used to work in the McClatchy D.C. Bureau, and at the time, McClatchy D.C. was a classic Washington news bureau for a chain of newspapers that, you know, that did that sort of thing. And they had a reporter who covered, you know, Texas and North Carolina and, you know, I mean, these were your states, and then you talked to the people from those states and you wrote about your stories from the perspective of, like, oh, there's a debate about the sequester. How will that affect North Carolina? And it was very sort of personalized, but oftentimes, like, it was personalized, and, you know, it was sort of like, oh, we're having a debate about Iraq, and here's what all the local members of Congress said about the war. And you'd read it and you'd go, well, basically, they all took the party line. You know, like,
yeah.
It wasn't necessarily surprising or interesting. It was kind of like, oh, okay, they all said what I expected them to say. And then on other occasions, you would have a story where it was like, whoa, hey, you know, one of our local members of Congress, like Walter Jones in North Carolina, was you know, against the war. And that was kind of a big deal because he was a Republican. And mm-hmm. he's not a normal Republican, but that was a story. So that might be a time when the regional approach did give you something that was kind of unique and of interest to people outside your area. So I think what we do is we try to avoid the first kind of story because, like, if everyone's just following the party line, then you don't really need to know anything other than what's the party line. And I found it useful sometimes to do an aggregation of, like, here are the 12 senators who bucked the party line on this issue, on mm-hmm. this vote, and then we'll name them and we'll go through them. Or if a particular senator from one of our states is really leading the way on an issue like the NSA or something is a big deal for us because their data centers in Utah. We've got members from Colorado and California who are taking really strong stances on this. You have the ability to go to them and say, well, I'm from I'm from Colorado or, you know, in that case, we had a Denver Post reporter who also here is in D.C. who wrote a story about, like, hey, you know, here's our local senator and why he's taking a stand on this. And we said that's of interest to everyone else too. Mm-hmm. And so, another example, we have paper in the Twin Cities, the Pioneer Press. Al Franken will only talk to Minnesota-based newspapers. So we have the opportunity to go to him and say, well, you know, we represent the Twin Cities. We'd like to talk to you about an issue that you're, you know, taking a stand on. And then it will also run in these other papers.
I think the sequester in particular is a good example of a story that in and of itself is difficult on its face for people to understand why this is important to me. And that in D.C. was such a – at least in the journalism realm, that was really a huge story. And the challenge was to explain to people the complexities of it, but then and why it really mattered, because it seemed like such a – like an in Washington thing, but in actuality, it had a huge impact on people's jobs, you know, on the government shutdown, on everything else, and it still will. What was your guys' approach to covering that?
Yeah, I found the sequester really hard. It was really hard because a lot of those things were still hypotheticals when it was being discussed, and it was hard to find regular people.
This will never happen, so don't worry about, you know.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you couldn't necessarily say, here's the head of some Indian school in Indian country who, you know, is going to lose a teacher because of this, because it wasn't known yet exactly who would be affected and how. And it was all sort of this big hypothetical that yet was going to have big effects on people. And when you can find like economists who say, well, this is going to cause such and so to happen to the economy, like people just don't believe that, even though like you can find all the economists in the world to agree on something. It doesn't really persuade people. And so it was just a very hard story to cover. But in general, I find this very frustrating about Washington, not being a born and bred Washington reporter, having moved here mid-career. So many of these stories are written for this this same audience.
Yeah.
I'm tired of reading stories that are written for me. Like, right. I get it. I'm already paying attention to this stuff, and it's fine. I'll read endless stories about what's going to happen with the vote next week and, you know, who they're targeting or whatnot. But there's really so little of this stuff where people try to make that connection between what is going on here and what it means out to the rest of the country.
And the other side of that is the fact that you have – you can almost write this story a week ahead of time because you know how the vote's going to go out. The people are going to
– Yeah, there is like more fake suspense in D.C. than on like a Spanish soap opera. Like it's always like, oh, it's the big drama. Like what will happen? Is John Boehner going to still be speaker in January? Yes.
Yes. That's not going to – well
– Yes, he will. We did a story that was like – there was some rumor that came up that John Boehner was thinking of you know, stepping down and retiring or whatever, and we wrote a piece. It was just an aggregation piece, but it was like eight other times, I can't remember the exact number, eight other times that John Boehner was supposedly not going to continue to be speaker. And we just found old stories that said Boehner may or may not be speaker, and it was just a sort of a light analysis that said, oh, hey, people are talking about this, like don't listen to it.
One thing we also try not to do is to follow every single vote between the chambers. And I mean, we follow it ourselves and we know what's going on, but we don't write about it for our readers. And it's tough to kind of take a step back and be like, this bill passed the Senate, you know, but we know it's not going to go anywhere in the House. So let's either find another way to write the story or leave it alone for now. And that's something we do that I think is very different. We're not necessarily covering like the minute by minute.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that ping pong thing. And the problem is that a lot of readers, when they see a headline that says, you know, House repeals Obamacare in vote, you know, that's why so many people think Obamacare was repealed. Like, I mean, like in polls, people said repeatedly they thought this law was already repealed because they swore that they read a headline that said House votes to repeal Obamacare. I mean, people don't always remember that. It needs to go to the Senate. The Senate's controlled by the Democrats. The president would veto it anyways. They don't have a veto-proof majority, blah, blah, blah. Like all that stuff, you know, goes over the heads, and all they really saw was repeal Obamacare votes, you know, yes.
Or a representative introduces a bill. Well, yeah, he introduces a bill. That doesn't mean it's going anywhere.
Yeah, you know, at CQ Roll Call, one of the things I ran was a website that had information on different legislation, and one of the most viewed items on our website was a gun control bill that had no co-sponsors. And that was introduced every single year by someone from Illinois. And you know, you'd look at it, and of course, this was getting passed around what they call dark social. People were emailing each other, look, here's the bill. This is the one. You know, they're going to take all our guns away. And you'd 5 seconds looking at it, and I could say, well, this bill is going nowhere. It has no co-sponsors. Right. you know, it's just not going anywhere. Like, but that doesn't necessarily that level of expertise, and even as minimal as it is, doesn't necessarily translate to I got an email from my brother-in-law telling me they're going to take my guns away.
Yeah. So there's something you mentioned before, aggregation journalism or aggregation writing, reporting. What does that mean?
Yeah, it can mean a few things. The first, I think, definition of that in terms of what we do is aggregating, you know, other stories related to a topic. The example I gave you, actually, I'll give you another example. I don't know if anyone listening had to write about the Supreme Court ruling this week related to the Obamacare birth control mandate. It was a whole complex story that really didn't mean too much. So what we tried to do was read all those stories and then write a sort of timeline. And it took a while to get the concept for this story together, so it's cohesive, but write a timeline and say, here's how we got to this point. Here's how, you know, we started with, like, you know, the very first Obamacare passed and the birth control mandate was a big part of it. And then we moved to, you know, religious groups don't like it, businesses don't like it. And it was this timeline explaining things. And we aggregated a bunch of stories about the topic that was happening that week related to this specific ruling on the birth control mandate to tell a broader explanation of the issue for our readers. So that's one example of aggregation.
Yeah, I think like an aggregation sometimes is just – we do it for a couple of reasons. And one is we don't believe in duplicating effort. Like digital first media and Project Thunderdome in particular is aimed at like understanding that newsrooms are not going to have the kind of staff in the future that they had in the past. You know, newsrooms were a monopoly business and they had huge staffs of people that did things like, you know, write movie reviews for a regional newspaper. Well, you know, guess what? Movies are the same like everywhere in the country basically. And so there's no particular reason for the Podunk Daily Times to have its own movie reviewer, like when that is something that can be done nationally and that there's a national audience for. And so we aggregate because we say, well, look, there's a ton of reporters in D.C. who are writing about all this stuff and covering all this stuff, but they're not necessarily writing about it for our audience. And I can quickly, I mean, on my most productive day, I've churned out four or five aggregations when there was a lot going on about stuff that was going on. Here's what it means. Here's what you need to know. And we write it fairly short and fairly tight. And we link to all the people who have reported this stuff. And sometimes we link to it favorably, like, oh, hey, so-and-so's reporting this. And that's an interesting little scoop that they have. And here's the story if you want to go check it out. And sometimes we report to it less favorably, like, oh, hey, this is being talked about and it's kind of dumb. But the point is that that allows us to be more efficient and that allows us to get to cover more things with a staff that right now is just two people. And then when we have the time, then Amber doesn't just do aggregation. She also will go and fully report out a story on something that we find particularly interesting. Like she found a bunch of people who lived in states where we have newspapers who were being affected by the unemployment benefits ending. And she talked to them about what it meant to them. And we wrote that as a pretty traditional news story, in part because no one was writing that story. And then we have a different way of sort of distributing it. And we distributed it as a sort of a must run so that it got a lot more coverage among our papers. And I think it's that balance. I think if we have more staff in the future in DC, we'll probably have more original reporting. But we'll always do a little bit of aggregation along the lines of what I think the Atlantic Wire, which is now known as The Wire, and The Week magazine do, which is, you know, aimed more at helping you understand the news. And then original reporting for stuff that we think no one else is writing about. Okay.
Yeah. The second type of aggregation is news events.
Okay.
That, for example, I talked about one at the very beginning where unemployment benefits were ending, and then we said, what else is happening that's affecting working class Americans? Let's put all those events together into one cohesive, understandable story. And we do that with the lighthearted stuff as well. Over Christmas, governor got a gun for Christmas and she, you know, took a photo and put it on Twitter. And everyone was writing this story. This governor got a gun. We had the idea to say, what did other, you know, politicians get for Christmas? And I sourced that solely through Twitter and put together this whole story. You know, this governor got a gun, but look at what everyone else got for Christmas. So we aggregate like news events as well.
Yeah, and social media is really great for that. I mean, I think that social media allows me to save the cost of one full reporter. Because I think in the past, there's no way that I could have run a Washington bureau without having someone who was just on the Hill all day long. Because you would have to have that person that you sent to go to Harry Reid's presser, to go to John Boehner's presser, to pester Eric Cantor in the hallway, to ask John McCain something and write down the funny thing he said in response. Because you just need it, right? But now I know who all those people are. I mean, I stalk people who work on the Capitol, you know, as reporters. I stalk them all. Like, I follow them all on Twitter. I watch what they're writing about all day. And if something happens, I notice it because immediately everyone's tweeting the same thing. And I go, oh, hey, whoa, that's interesting. You know, this Boehner just said this thing about the Tea Party. We should know. We should do something with that. Let's get on it. Or, oh, someone just tweeted that it looks like they're going to have a vote. Or, well, Rand Paul is starting a filibuster. That's kind of unexpected. And everyone's suddenly talking about it. You know, let's turn on C-SPAN and see if we can catch that. And so it functions as this sort of, you know, free
sourcing system.
I mean, and it's vetted. I mean, I'm not just grabbing random things off Twitter. I mean, these are all people that I know, either some of them I know personally or that I know where they work and I can see that they work there and they, you know, they're verified accounts. And we know, and you know them, you also kind of know who's there and how reliable they are based on what they've done in the past. I mean, there's people, sometimes they tweet stuff and you're like, okay, you know, mental note, like this person sometimes tweets stuff that's not exactly accurate. But it gives you kind of an advanced warning system that I don't think you used to have.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that because I found this kind of fascinating. You know, we've had conversations in the past on the podcast a lot about social media and how journalists use it. I mean, you seem to be somebody who is really embracing the and recognizing that social media is a part of the journalist toolbox. And you know, how do you, you know, how's that process work for you in a day? You know, what do? You have like a list of people that you don't regularly follow? Are you on Twitter all the time? Do you have, you know, TweetDeck up on your desktop all the time?
I actually have two monitors, and one basically is just so that I can have TweetDeck up without having to, you know, worry if I'm working on something, writing a story or something like that, I can still have TweetDeck on the other monitor. And you can actually kind of tell out of the corner of your eye if something newsy is happening because it just speeds up.
Fast.
Yeah, it's like someone turned the dial up because the tweets start coming more quickly. And I also use Twitter on my phone. So I, you know, in the mornings, if I, you know, if I wake up on the couch holding my infant son, I'll just turn my phone on and flip through and just check to see if people are tweeting about something. I think I use Twitter for reporting, and I what I aim for is Facebook for distribution. You know, you really don't get much traffic from Twitter to your stories, and you really shouldn't write your stories for Twitter because the only stuff that really goes on Twitter is breaking news, and you'd have to devote yourself full time to breaking news to make that work. But if you write something in a clever way with a smart headline, then you can there's some kind of drone filming us right now. There's a drone.
It's flying right outside the office.
This is the news right here. That's unusual. This is what happens when you have a corner office with big windows.
Okay. So I post one podcast and I'm gonna leave this in because this is kind of interesting. We're at a radio station in Northwest DC. We've got a large window. And there seems to be a drone flying outside our window.
It's like it's looking at it.
I've been trying to signal this without, you
know.
Yeah,
without making too much noise.
Using noise.
You know, I did post a podcast just this morning about hacking. I can't imagine it's going that quickly. We are across the street from a police station, and they're also doing construction, so it could very well be something as innocent as that. But this is America.
They're probably just curious. They saw us through the window and wanted to look in. We, you know, we have a news drone. We actually are looking at using drones for news. The laws are still unclear on it. And so as an organization, we've tried to stay on the shiny, bright side of legality on that. But we play around with them. Like, you know, right now, basically, you can't use drones for news gathering outside, according to the FAA, but you can use them indoors. So you could take a drone to a stadium or something like that.
Interesting.
For a car show or something.
Blimps that they drive.
Yeah,
they,
I mean,
they
you
drop
could
t-shirts from. Or
we've
whatever.
Done we've done some, and we've just played around. I mean, we also have like a Google Glass. I mean, it's interesting. Having worked at a number of different news organizations, I have never worked at a place that is as that's an NPR reporter, isn't it? That looks like an NPR reporter.
Yeah.
Maybe it isn't. I've worked at a number of different news.
Let's stop for a second. Okay. All right, we'll back.
You want to start back?
Yeah, we can go ahead and start. All right, well, we took a short break there. It was kind of a fun little moment. It turns out that there was a drone outside of our window that had something to do with another radio program that's being recorded here. Tech Talk with Jim Russ. It's on WFED in D.C. on 9 a.m. on Saturdays. Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University had brought his drone and was demonstrating it outside our window. So we all, of course, were immediately fascinated by that and stopped the podcast to go out and talk to him. But now you just told me you have Digital First has a drone up at its New York office?
Digital First Media's New York office has a drone that they've just been experimenting with, sort of what could we do with it, how does it work, what kind of video does it get, you know, what are the limitations on it. And, you know, the same thing with one of our editors was an early adopter in the Google Glass, and we have that and we played around with it. We haven't yet. It's not like we've gone, okay, now, you know, every Digital First Media reporter needs a Google Glass on all the time. But, you know, every Digital First Media reporter does have a smartphone so that we can take video and has a Tout account so that we can post the video online. So it's not inconceivable that at some point in the future we might say, hey, the cops reporter should always be wearing Google Glass so that they can quickly get a photo or a video if something happens. You know, I don't know that that's necessarily what's going to happen. But the point of technology is that you never really know when it first starts out. I mean, I think if you go back and you look at the early days of television, what you had was a lot of old white dudes basically reading a newspaper story out loud. I mean, Walter Cronkite, you know, bless his heart, but it's like, yeah, so, yeah, I mean, yeah, they still do that on like New York One. I mean, like C-SPAN does it too. Like, well, let's see what's in the morning papers. I'm like, really? You know, but that was what they thought. Well, TV is reading a newspaper out loud. And then at some point they were like, whoa, you know, TV is about video. And news values changed. People looked at something like a warehouse fire in which no one died three states from here is news on TV because it's interesting to look at. It's not news in a newspaper because there's nothing happened. You know, maybe you'd put a photo or something, but if it happened a far distance away. And that's why TV always has these really ambiguous geographical definitions too. When I was in North Carolina, my favorite thing is they would say, tonight in the heart of Carolina. What's the heart of Carolina? That's basically anywhere in North Carolina where something happened that we want to kind of vaguely relate to Raleigh, you know, a murder in the heart of Carolina. You go, oh my God. And you look at it and it's like, what? Salisbury? Like, that's nowhere near here. Why are we even talking about that?
Well, and the changing of platforms, I mean, the switch to digital is, you know, finding sort of redefining the way we tell news on digital has been a process as well. That we're
yeah, and there's been phases of it. I mean, I think if you look at, there was sort of the Huffington Post, you know, model of SEO, everything was SEO, and the famous headline was, you know, what time is the Super Bowl? Like, and the story began, like, the Super Bowl is at 8 p.m. What time is the Super Bowl? The Super Bowl will be at 8 p.m. The 8 p.m. Super Bowl will begin at 8 p.m. And that was just all about SEO. And then you had kind of the BuzzFeed, the listicle approach, and then this last year has been the Upworthy, Curiosity Gap. Can we write like something that you just have to click on because we don't tell you what it says? And
we just tease you into some.
Yeah, I mean, everything has become the last story before the commercial break. You know, that they on the TV news when they were like, coming up next, what item in your child's lunchbox could kill them? And then you're like, oh my God, I have to keep watching. You know, and then like, spork, yeah, spork,
head.
Really?
The
no
cigarettes or whatever. It's funny you talk about SEO and everything. I just had something this last week when one of the snowstorms was coming up, and there was concern about whether it wasn't the snowstorm. It was Christmas Eve, whether the federal government was going to get the day off. And, you know, that's kind of important for the website that I work on because, you know, our audience are federal employees. And I got a call from upstairs from TOP, and they said, "Have you heard anything? Because one of the local TV stations is saying that, you know, the Office of Personnel Management has made this announcement." And so I went and I checked it out, and there was a story on their website. From what I could tell, it was something they had created out of a story they had last year when the federal government had gotten the day off. But it basically it said that no, they were going to have to go to work. But the URL said federal employees don't have to work.
Right.
So I was kind of like, well, why do they have the URL that way? And so I figured it was either because they built it off of an old story, or that was the URL they
wrote.
You had
an incorrect headline the first time, and oftentimes the URL right. shows the headline. There's been a couple of examples of that. There was a time when the New York Times had like kind of a semi-racist, I always say the word racish, headline.
Racish
is something that's kind of racist, but it's hard to – but they had kind of a racish headline on something. And then they changed it, but it remained in the URL, and people were pointing out, like, oh, my gosh, look at the URL on this.
It was just an SEO issue. We were just trying to, you know, because people, you know, are thinking that way, that that's the way they're searching for it or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think that there's also debunking is just a whole new element of the news that there didn't used to be, because it's a lot easier now to point at something and say, this other news agency wrote it, and this is not true. And I think that has been – there's a positive side of that, which is that it's a lot harder to write something that's not accurate. And the negative side of it is that, like, I think sometimes we get into – you can kind of crawl into this debunking wormhole where just everything is this true or not? And some of the debunking, I mean, the other day there was a thing on, I think, PolitiFact that was like, is it true that Obamacare will cause beheadings? You know, the answer is no. And it was like –
why even give well, that?
How do we
light
even get
day?
Into this? I mean, I gather that someone on the internet is arguing that Obamacare regulations are going to lead to beheadings, but you know, like, is this even something we need to get into?
Where
we need
any to like thought that you have down? In your head is can be. Can
but
be
someone out there is saying it, and someone is linking to it. So at some point, PolitiFact gets involved.
Thank you, internet.
Sometimes we run into should our headline cater to SEO or the curiosity gap. A perfect example of that was the other day when Clay Aiken was considering a run for Congress. Did we put Clay Aiken in the headline? Did everyone know who he was? Or did we say this former reality TV star might run for Congress?
Yeah, I think the consensus in the New York side was that Clay Aiken was not enough of a household name that people were actively searching for this.
I think you do. What former TV, you know, name the TV show star?
Like, I mean, what former American Idol star or something? Yeah, we ended up going with a curiosity gap. We said, what, you know, this former reality TV star. Because we thought more people would click on it wanting to know who it was than would necessarily be going, you know, what's up with Clay Aiken at that particular day. But there's always kind of a trade-off. And I think what we're trying to do is understand how all these other news organizations, what their method is, and when can we borrow that method, when do we not need to use that method, when do we do a different method.
So it's not like everything's SEO, everything's curious.
No, we're not. And I think, like, you know, I mean, I think, and God bless them, you know, places like the BuzzFeed where everything is a listicle, you know, that I think that approach works sometimes. And I think that what I look at it now is that you're not like a newspaper reporter. You're not a radio reporter. You're not a TV reporter. You're a reporter. And you look at it and say, is this a primarily visual story? If it is, can I get video? If I can get video, how do I make it interesting? What do I do with it to make this a video story? And if it's not a video story, I mean, there's a lot of stories you watch on the TV news. And, you know, they do this thing where, like, they'll show a factory putting pills in a bottle so that they can talk about, like, a prescription drug law, regulation, whatever. And you're like, man, they are trying so hard to make this a visual story because it's just not. Mm-hmm. You know, or the thing on TV where they show a document and then they like zoom in on this like carefully made graphic cutout of like three words from the document, you know, and it's like, wow, that's just not a visual thing, you know. Yeah. So there are certain stories that work well as a listicle. There are certain stories that work well as a sort of fun, you know, hey, which former reality star curiosity gap sort of upworthy headline thing. There are certain stories that work well as you know, certain things that work well as a podcast. I don't think anyone needs to see the two of us to you know, get what we're saying. So you look at each story and say, which method am I going to use for this?
Yeah.
And I think for us, I think the rule tends to be, can we make it as visual as possible while still relaying information that the average reader cares about and putting that information in bite-sized chunks. That's like the bottom line for us.
So yeah, we really like to do a lot of scrolling with a lot of photos in it because I think it keeps people's interest when you have a big, long – when you have a traditional newspaper story on the web, people read it, but I don't think they really enjoy it. I think when we do it – I mean, I'm just being honest here. You know, when we put it on there, we try to break it into – to disparate parts and sort of make a point and then have a photo that's associated with it and then make another point and have a photo that's associated with that. And
or even better, a video or embedded tweet.
Yeah, a video or, yeah, here's the tweet from the guy that said this.
Are you thinking of mobile at that point where that most people are going to be looking at this on their phone or?
Yeah, but I think people are reading in that mindset even when they're at their desktop anymore. I think when you really have the two forms of reading – and I think when people are on an iPad or they're on a Kindle or they're reading a traditional magazine or they're with a traditional book and they're sitting down and they're in that kind of deep reading, then yes, they want to read just text and really kind of dive into that sort of New Yorker style mode of writing. But when you're on the web, you often should be doing something else. You know, you're often
pick up
like.
Your room.
Yeah, I mean, you're reading because you're like, oh, you know, it's 10 minutes till lunchtime. I don't really want to start writing that memo. Like, I wonder what's going on. And you're in this kind of scavenger mode. And I think so if you kind of maybe think about it, it's like there is a type of journalism where you really want to hunt the woolly mammoth. You know, you're going to go, you're going to take down the woolly mammoth. You're going to skin its carcass and you're going to feed the village for a month. And there's other times when you really just want to go eat some like nuts and berries and you're just going to kind of go wander around and grab a few berries here and a few berries there. And oh, look, there's an acorn and you're going to eat that. And you're not really looking at, I need some, you know, big chunk. You're really just looking at, I want a lot of little things. And so the key for us is, can we make those little things still teach you something and not just, you know, empty calories? Can we have you pick something up? And if you're doing this enough, that you're really going to know the big picture stories that are going on.
Thank you for speaking in a metaphor that speaks to the cavemen in our audience.
We're all cavemen, really, at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I'm not arguing with that. Before we go, I did want to talk a little bit about this hyperlocal blog you got going on in Hyattsville.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about this hyperlocal blog you've got going in Hyattsville.
Well, my wife and I moved to Hyattsville, Maryland, 3-4 years ago, and it's kind of an up-and-coming area. It's similar for people in the D.C. area. It's similar to Tacoma Park, but it's not yet as expensive and as hip. And there is a local newspaper called the Hyattsville Life and Times, which is distributed monthly and is a nonprofit and is very – you know, they have a gardening column by Miss Floribunda and you know, very sort of – you know. It's good stuff, but it's small town newspaper stuff, and it's
very
slow.
Do you also have the Washington Post chain of community newspapers there covering Hyattsville?
No, I mean, the Gazette comes out occasionally.
Okay.
They're not there on a regular basis, and they really only come out when they can find something that would be a broader interest. So they're not really writing for Hyattsville as much as just going, oh, hey, look, something happened in Hyattsville that might be of interest to people outside.
There are things that the Post does well, but once you start talking about local coverage, it kind of sort of thins out.
Yeah, and they don't have the manpower anymore for that kind of thing. And there's 17,000 people live in Hyattsville, and that's coincidentally the size of the first town that I worked at a newspaper. And so and there's this kind of new influx of stuff there that wasn't getting covered because it's so new. So we decided, and at the time there was Patch, but Patch, you know, the one sort of flaw with Patch is that they sort of tended to camp out at City Hall and write stories about what the city council talked about. And like, honestly, like having been a city council reporter for years and years, like no one cares. Because really, no one cares. Like 90% of the time, no one cares about that stuff. And it's important to have someone
until the bulldozers move in.
Yeah, I mean, like inevitably, people would show up. What? I'm outraged. They're doing what?
Why didn't I have an opportunity to say anything 2 years ago?
You know, but like most of the time, you're there alone. And most of the time, they're talking about stuff that people just aren't that interested in. And so what really wasn't getting covered in Hyattsville was the sort of feature stuff. And so we decided to start a blog called the Hyattsville Wire. It's at hyattsvillewire.com. And we said first rules was no crime, because the one story that is covered in Hyattsville is crime. Like if something happens, there's some crime, like the Washington Post reporter will come out and write about the crime. And oftentimes in Hyattsville in particular, there's a lot of unincorporated Prince George's County that gets called Hyattsville in news stories. And this is sort of endlessly frustrating because it's like, you know, man found wandering naked in Hyattsville. And then you look at it and it's like way out by the stadium. And you're like, this is like 20 miles from where anywhere where Hyattsville police or, mm-hmm. or city council or, you know, or residents could be expected to reasonably control. And so it's kind of irritating because you're like, that's not really Hyattsville. Like, so no crime and no politics, because I cover politics. And I get enough of that during the day. So we wrote about local artists because it's an arts district. There's a lot of artists. And so we'll do a Q&A with an artist. Or we'll show a piece of art and just say, hey, here's a piece of art by a local artist. It's kind of interesting. We do my wife is really interested in real estate. It's kind of funny because I'm the journalist. She does PR. She writes about real estate, and those are always like the most read things on the site. But, you know, we'll write about things going on in the historic district, home for sale or a building for sale. You know, so kind of talking about changes going on there, write about local businesses, something like – a little ballet studio for kids opened up. And mm-hmm. so, you know, we saw that there was a sign saying coming soon, and we got a hold of the person, interviewed them, and threw up just like quick, you know, very quick stuff. It's 5-6 paragraph sort of blog post things. And then and then because it's a blog and we, you know, have the freedom, we'll sometimes do kind of like a deeper read on like, you know, okay, what's missing, why we need a coffee shop, you know, in the area. Or, you know, here's an interesting piece of someone put up a wheat paste poster on a local building. And so I did a piece that was like, hey, this is kind of interesting because this particular artist is a DC artist, and he puts these posters up. It's a self-portrait of himself like around town in kind of hip areas in DC. As kind of a marketing move, it doesn't say who he is on it, and it's sort of a mysterious, it's kind of a steampunk. The self-portrait of him wearing like
I've
a
seen that. Yeah,
you've seen it. Yeah. Mean. It's this guy, and it's like his self-promotional effort. And the idea is that it's sort of you recognize it and you're like, who is that guy? And so he put one up in Hyattsville. And so I wrote a piece that was saying like, this is actually kind of a big deal that like this guy is – I mean this guy's so hip it bleeds, right? You know, that
Hyattsville has arrived.
That he would come – yeah, that was the point. Like that he would come all the way to Hyattsville because he would feel the need to put one up in Hyattsville. You know, here's something you might have seen while you're out walking around. Here's what it means. And it's fun. I mean, it's a low traffic blog. We've gotten about 70,000 posts in about a year and a half, 70,000 page views in a year and a half. But almost all of that traffic is local. So you think about a town of 17,000 people. We got a couple hundred fans on Facebook, a couple hundred followers on Twitter, you know, 66, I think, people signed up to get every blog post by email. So it's a very small audience. We don't do any advertising right now. And we're not really trying to monetize it in any way. And we've only put a couple hundred bucks into it total anyways. So it's really just sort of for fun. But it gives me a chance to try different things out. It's kind of fun because I used to be a local reporter, and so it gives me a chance to kind of keep my ties to that. And then it just helps me think about journalism. I think it's always important to be thinking about like how journalism works and what your strategy is. And sometimes when you're just doing your job day in and day out, you kind of lose focus on the big picture stuff. And that's how you get left behind, is that, well, this is our business model and this is our editorial strategy and this is what we've always done and we're going to do it. And then one day, you know, oh, hey, someone came along and figured out that there was a gap in coverage and exploited that, and now we're being left behind. That's happened to a lot of news agencies. So I think anything you can do to keep yourself thinking fresh and saying, is there a different way to do what we're doing? Is there a different way to organize this? Is there a different strategy we could be trying? Is useful in that respect.
And the thing is that journalists are journalists 24 hours a day. I mean, they clock in and they do their job and they meet their deadlines and everything, and then they go home. But when they're shopping, when they're, you know, at their children's school or stuff, they're always seeing things. They're like, I wonder where that is.
Oh, yeah.
Who's responsible for that?
I was waiting in a grocery store, and I saw a woman dumpster dive, and I wanted to do another post on like, oh, my God, we've arrived. We have dumpster divers at the organic grocery store.
Dumpster diving.
Boy, kids are sleeping in the car, and I was like, I can't get out of the car to go talk to a dumpster diver. But, you know.
There was a pipe burst at the school that my son was at. They were doing their Christmas concert, and the pipe burst. And
oh, jeez.
I dropped my kids at home and went back to school and took pictures.
Yeah.
Because I'm sick that way.
Well, that's why I said no crime, because then you just get sucked into that world.
Oh, no.
But, you know, I think now Patch is really scaled down, and so we're
there's some things I like that Patch did. You know, I know it had its, you know.
One thing I liked was that there were certain stories I was like, okay, I don't have to write that because I know Patch will write that.
Yeah.
You know, now I feel a little bit more obligation to cover some of that stuff because there's not really anyone doing it. Or I mean, the Heights for Life and Times will get to it, but it'll be a month from now, you know.
Yeah.
And not all of those – they don't see everything the way I see it, you know. So they may not necessarily write about it, you know, mm-hmm. or give you those kind of quick hit updates.
Yeah, and I think with Patch, it really is, you know, community to community, it's really different. It really depends on who the writer is and how committed they are to, you know.
That was the flaw with Patch, was that the hyperlocal idea was great, but the execution was so generic. And mm-hmm. like I'm saying, I mean, we live in an arts district with this historic area. It's undergoing a lot of development. Like, I just thought, you know, real estate, the arts, like – history, like, these are big things, like, for Hyattsville. And yet, you know, the coverage was the same as they were doing in anywhere else in Patch. And I think ultimately, you know, hyperlocal can only work if it has more flexibility to say, okay, this is what's interesting to our audience and follow that, rather than trying to sort of come in and give you what you think you need.
Yeah. It's sort of a McDonald's approach that you were going
to
give you.
Yeah. I mean, I try to look more like Starbucks. I mean, one of the things Starbucks is, it's the same product everywhere. But I mean, one of the things that's fascinating about Starbucks is every building is different. You know, they really don't try to come in and just build a McDonald's like mm-hmm. in the same. They'll come in and they'll find an existing building, or they'll even build one of their own. But it's always a little different. And that respects the local
right.
architecture. And it doesn't make Starbucks stand out as just totally garish, you know.
Right. Because people, I mean, you know, the ubiquity of Starbucks, everybody's like, oh, no, there's no
It
Starbucks.
Is everywhere. If every Starbucks was built like a Pizza Hut, you would just hate Starbucks because they're everywhere.
I was going to bring this back to Digital First Media.
Yes,
Ryan made a link.
Yes, the people who actually pay us.
They're awesome. Ryan made a link between like covering national news and then going home and covering hyperlocal, and how it keeps him fresh. It keeps him not stuck in the day-to-day and able to think about what works and drop what doesn't. And that's something that Digital First Media really requires of its employees, and that works well. I believe there's a lot of journalism students that listen to this.
Yeah.
When I got hired on a few months ago, that was something that was very key, was can you handle that kind of startup mentality and be okay to let go of what you're doing because it doesn't work and try something new that you've never tried before.
And I think it's one of the exciting things about this type of journalism.
Absolutely.
Is that it challenges you to try new things and fail, and then try something else that may work or maybe.
Yeah, I mean, my job is
new
changed.
Solutions.
I mean, in the time when I started, I was one of the first employees because they wanted to get the politics up and running before the election. And so when I started, I was doing just like nonstop coverage of the presidential election and managing a content management system that was a certain way and relating to my coworkers in a certain way. And then, you know, and then we had kind of a next wave where a bunch of new people came on and we had to kind of figure out how we all work together. And then, you know, how New York is structured, like now we have a breaking news team, you know, like I have Amber, we have other producers up there that I work with. We've had some people who were hired like to do a very specific job, and then the job just completely changed. I mean, we got one poor guy in New York who's probably on his like sixth actual title. My job has changed almost as much, although it's just focused. It's always been politics, but it's like my actual day-to-day responsibilities, what I do, how I do it, how we talk has changed and will change again. And some people, you know, aren't into that, and some people are. What's great about our coworkers is that, you know, they're all people who are really interested in trying new stuff and all are very much okay with like, well, that didn't work. You know, we tried it, didn't work. Like, but we learned something from it. Let's move on.
Yeah. And that's actually one of the things that I find exciting about the times that we're in now in journalism, where it used to be not the things that, I don't know if the word is staid, but there was certainly a structure to the way newspapers were set up, newsrooms were set up, that this is the way, you know, we cover things, this is the way we do things. And the reporter had to change to sort of get into that. And
it was, frankly, it was depressing. I graduated from college in 1997, and I I had a couple internships under my belt, and I had an internship at a daily newspaper. And I said, look, this is my goal. I set out my long-term goal to some of the editors that I knew, and they said, here's what you need to do. And you know, the first thing was go work in a small newspaper for two to three years, and then go to a slightly bigger newspaper, you know, in the same state, but, you know, probably way on the other side of the state for a slightly larger circulation, work there for 3 to 4 years. And then, you know, and it was depressing. I mean, it was like, you know, you had to sort of do the stations of the cross to get to a point where you could finally get a job at like a bigger newspaper in a city that you wanted to live in. And then the idea was that you would just, you know, work your way up the ranks there from the local city desk all the way to the state desk or whatever, and then die. And now it's like they people say, what's your 5-year goal? And I'm like, oh, heck, I'm not even getting into that because I have no idea what we're doing. Maybe in 5 years from now, I'll be the drone editor. You know,
there
I
you go.
It's just not even worth trying to figure out what my 5-year goal is anymore because it will change so much. But it's also way less depressing. Way more fun.
When I was in Northern Virginia as an editor, we had a county reporter who was covering Fairfax County like nobody else. He knew where all the bodies were buried. He just had this. He was young. He had this drive, and you know, just great writing stories much better than anything that was in the Post at the time. And you know, he was in conversations with the guy at the Post, but the guy at the Post wouldn't hire him because you know he was young. He hadn't gone out and done stuff, and it was just like, really? I mean, here's somebody who has all the connections, who has all the experience, who has the drive, and you're not going to give him the opportunity because of whatever the system is.
Yeah.
And you're just perpetuating a system. Well, goodbye. That stuff's gone. Now we're into something different. We're redefining what those roles are and the paths that we take.
Yeah, I mean, I tell my students, I point to someone like Andrew Kaczynski, who works at BuzzFeed. You know, he basically Twittered his way to a job. You know, I mean, he just found stuff interesting every day and was tweeting it and got people. I mean, I started following him when he was still in college because he would tweet at me or respond to things or retweet me. And, if, you know, you'd sort of you start to notice like, oh, that's a name I've seen before. And then you look at them and you say, well, this person has interesting stuff, and you follow them. And then eventually got hired by BuzzFeed and basically still kind of does the same kind of stuff, you know, for BuzzFeed. So, you know, that just wasn't an option. In 1997, there was no way that I could correspond directly with, you know, reporters, get them to notice me, you know, and then build my own following. And then, you know, I mean, I think basically today the idea is that you should make yourself an expert. You should create your own audience. And then you go to the publication and say, these are the people I bring with me.
Right. You know, build your brand.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm glad that you talked about that, especially as somebody who is teaching young journalists, because, you know, we've heard from people that, you know, how do I do this? How do I get into this? And you know, quite often the answer is, well, the answer is yourself. You need to figure out what you have, you know, what skills you have, what you want to do, and then find a way to do that.
I think, and too, also, if you go back and ask people who were hired years ago, I mean, I remember when I was trying to get a job way back when, and I would ask people, how'd you get your job? And they always were the most improbable stories. I mean, you know, this one guy was like, oh, I got hired by mistake, you know, because they thought I didn't send a resume along with it, and they thought I had more experience than, you know, I did, because my little sister answered the phone and said I was at the AP, but, you know, I was just like,
well, you were at the A and P.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, like, you know, it's just like, you know, oh yeah, well, who knows, you know, so there's always been an element of chance to getting hired by a big publication. I think there's just a lot more routes to that than there used to be.
Yeah.
It's a lot less linear.
Well, before we check out here, I wanted to ask you about Taiwan. How long were you in Taiwan and what was your experience there?
Yeah, I was there for a year, and I went abroad with my now husband to go abroad because why not? I was young. Still am young. And I thought it'd be really cool to get like one or two clips for a Western publication while I was there. But because I had networked so well here in D.C. before I left, and then there in Taiwan, I joined a foreign correspondence group. I ended up being a stringer for the Washington Post, and we got to like interview the president, and I helped cover the tsunami and did a big travel feature for the Post, among other Western publications. So I had a a blast.
That sounds like.
Yeah. I think that was one of the things that impressed me about Amber when I was trying to make a decision to hire. It's not like Taiwan had some direct relevance to digital first media, but sense that she could throw herself into an unusual situation and come out with some news stories, you know, I think is the kind of thing that you should be doing if you're a young journalist or a journalism student is showing that you can think on your feet, you know, and showing that you have the guts, you know, to go chase stuff.
Cool. Well, that sounds like a good place to stop. Well, thank you very much for both coming in.
Thanks for having us.
That's fun.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of media.
You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about It's All Journalism at itsalljournalism.com.
We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics that you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com.
Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @alljournalism.